Chapter 63. There would be, I concluded, chaos in my next life. Lying next to May in our polite suburban home, paid for by drug smugglers and fraudsters, I would stare at the shadows of leaves swaying across the ceiling and consider questions hundreds of years apart. Those Kalachakra whose memories had been wiped would wake with the same confusion and madness that I myself had experienced in my early lives. Usually, after a forgetting, Cronus Club members would appear in the second life to shield the terrified child from the worst traumas of that experience and to guide them through that most difficult of times. But to do so now, with Vincent clearly aware of the identities of so many Kalachakra, risked an exposure for those of us, however many there were, still with our memories intact. And yet, what if we did not? Future generations of the Cronus Club, for hundreds of years, were relying on the 20th century members to protect them, to assist them. What would they do without the groundwork we laid? They would find their way, I concluded, as they had no choice in the matter. The more pressing question lay in the here and now. What would I do, one of the privileged few who still recalled the nature of my own being, when, in the next life, the asylums of this world began to fill with men and women whose minds had been ripped apart by Vincent? I needed to find a Cronus Club which had not been touched by Vincent Rancus's purge. Even one would be enough, whose members still knew who they were. By 1958, it was apparent that the only club I was likely to find which would fit this description was in Beijing. It was not a good year to visit Beijing. The Hundred Flowers campaign had been briskly and effectively terminated when the Communist government of China realized that granting cultural freedom was not the same as winning cultural praise. Now the Great Leap Forward was commencing, in which the people of the nation would be fired up to advance China, sacrificing tools and metal, time and energy, lives and strength for the good of the nation. Anywhere between 18 and 30 million people would die of the starvation which ensued. Getting in as a Westerner was almost impossible. But I had enough criminal contacts in Russia to acquire a cover as a Soviet academic sent to Beijing to share knowledge of industrial techniques and expand my knowledge of Mandarin. Speaking Mandarin with a Russian accent is extremely difficult. Of all the languages I have learned, Mandarin took me the longest, and having to replicate the suitable tones while simultaneously presenting myself as a rather bumbling Soviet scholar was an exercise that caused me considerable distress. In the end, I chose to emphasize my Russian accent over any great accuracy in language, producing endless sly smiles from my hosts, and the nickname of Professor Sing-Song, which fairly quickly became the name by which all knew me anyway. Even though I was, technically, an ally from a friendly nation, my movements in Beijing were heavily restricted. It was a city going through tumultuous change, but with the state of the country being what it was, that change was hideously piecemeal. Whole districts of old Qing housing had been knocked down in a go, though no resources existed to replace the lost abodes. Great skyscrapers had been begun, but then could not be completed, so a roof was slotted on some four floors up, as if to say, "This was our plan all along." Posters were everywhere, and the propaganda was some of the most colourful, and, to my sensibilities at least, the most naive I had ever seen. Ranging from the traditional staples of communist rule, images of happy families striving together against a red sky in a well-tended field, through to more unusual campaigns, such as suggestions that keeping potted plants would encourage clean living, or exhortations to mind your personal hygiene for the good of the nation. They reminded me of a sort of school art project plastered across the city. Nevertheless, the fervour behind much of the propaganda could not be denied, at least among our louder hosts, who spouted the rhetoric of the time with the passion of priests and who would, in a few years yet to come, probably believe the Cultural Revolution to be the greatest time of their lives. It was a reminder of the old truth that for tyranny to flourish, all it required was the complicity of good men. In China at that time, how many millions of good men, I wondered, were silently watching while this louder, snappier minority of believers marched and sang their way towards famine and destruction. By day, I taught classes of hard-faced, earnest young technocrats everything I could remember about Russian industrial dogma of the time. I even drew up entirely fictitious graphs and charts, discussed non-existent steelworks and ways of motivating the workers, and took questions at the end of every session, such as, "Professor Singsong, sir, is it not encouraging ideological weakness to offer reward to supervisors for increasing factory output? Should not the supervisor always remain equal to all his workers?" To which the answer was, "The supervisor is a servant of his workers, for they are the producers and he is not. However, there must be a clear leadership figure in every organization, otherwise we have no means of gathering information on its success or failure, nor can we rely on universal policies being implemented at the lowest level. In the matter of rewarding the supervisor for success, we find that if you do not, the motivation of the supervisor and the workers declines, and they may not struggle as hard in the following year." "But, sir, would not a campaign of indoctrination in correct thinking be the appropriate response to this?" I smiled and nodded and spoke utter, empty, vapid lies. I had very specifically requested that my time in Beijing be limited to 3 months. I did not think I could sustain my deception any longer than that, and wished to have an effective extraction route available should my cover ever be blown. I had also established links with the triads in Hong Kong, and, at my request and to their great trepidation, they had sent a team of 5 men north, ready to assist me at any given moment. Neither the men nor the triad appreciated that it would be I myself in Beijing using their resources, but rather assumed, as always, that I was operating through a proxy. The first time I met them, I was alarmed to see how poorly their clothes blended with their surroundings, for they still carried hints of Hong Kong bling about them, new shoes and clean trousers, soft skin, and, to my horror, one even smelled of expensive aftershave. I berated them in a mixture of Russian and Mandarin, and was slightly comforted to discover that their Mandarin was excellent, albeit with strong Hunan accents. As I worked, they went in search of the Cronus Club, spreading out through the criminal underworld of Beijing, one cautious whisper at a time, for the government was nothing if not savage to criminals it caught. The Beijing Cronus Club. I had been reluctant to try it even at the beginning of my mission, for in the 20th century it had a rather dubious reputation among the clubs of the world. For so much of its existence, Beijing is a stable, pleasant, reliable club, something of a tourist destination indeed, for if you can make the journey to its door, it offers a degree of stability and luxury unrivalled by most other clubs until well into the 1890s. However, from 1910, the club increasingly shuts down, becoming much as the Leningrad Club was in 1950, a shadow club, a place to support its youth, but little more. By the 1960s, the Beijing Club is a bare whisper on the air, and several times, despite the best precautions of its members, it has fallen victim to the Cultural Revolution. In Soviet Russia, that kind of attack on luxury and intellectualism may be bribed or blackmailed into submission. But during the madness of those months, not even the Kalachakra can accurately predict the outcome of events. The club has also suffered other problems in the 20th century, a large number of which are ideological. Its members have always been very proud of China, of their nation, and for several lives, most will fight on this or that side during the prolonged civil war. However, eventually the more pragmatic members will come to realize that nothing they do will alter the course of events, and several leave, bitter and disappointed at the fate that awaits their country. Those who stay, and there are many indeed, are often caught up in a battle between national pride, an awareness of the bigger picture which many of their linear contemporaries lack, and the same ideological fervour which has so often destroyed the club itself. When all you can see, day in and day out, are banners proclaiming the glory of communism, and your whole intellectual world is defined by this great rallying cry, against which you have no tool or defence, then, like a prisoner in a jail cell, those walls become your life. So it can be with the Beijing Cronus Club, and its members, fiery, passionate, angry, bitter, incensed, committed, rejected, carry a dubious reputation in the 20th century. I am told that in the 21st, the club's nature changes again, and it becomes more of a place for luxury and security as it had been before, but I have never known those days. Finding the Beijing Club at the best of times is tricky. These were quite possibly the worst of all times to even consider looking, but to look, I had no choice. It took 2 months, and I was already beginning to struggle under the pressure of colleagues at the university, whispering that Professor Singsong was not doctrinally correct. The doctrine I spouted was in fact absolutely correct for the times we lived in, but I had underestimated how quickly the times changed and, vitally, how much more important the interpretations of rivals were than the truth of what you said. I calculated I only had a few weeks until I was deported, and deportation would be the soft option. When the message came through, it wasn't a moment too late. It took the form of a small folded slip of paper under my door, written in Russian. It read, "Have met a friend. Drop by for tea. 6 p.m. beneath the lantern." Beneath the lantern was established code for a small tea house, one of the very few tea houses still left in Beijing, which had been kept open largely for the benefit of the party elite and visiting scholars such as myself, to enjoy the service of attentive young women who could be extra attentive for only a little more incentive. The madam of the tea house wore a plain white robe at all times, but her hair was done up in a great crown of metal sticks and jewels, and I had never seen the smile falter, even for a second, on her wide round face. To show the tea house's commitment to the great leap forward, all the low metal chairs on which guests had previously been sat had been contributed to industry, and now guests sat on red pillows on the floor. The move had been met with great praise from the party secretaries who drank there, and eventually a gift of 20 lacquered wooden seats from one secretary in particular, who found his knees could no longer handle sitting cross-legged. I met my informant, one of the triad boys, on the corner of the tight alley where the tea house resided. It was raining, the hard northern rain that blows in from Manchuria and makes the tiles of the curving roofs clatter with every heavy drop. He began to walk as I approached, and I fell in some 50 yards behind him, checking the streets as we moved through them for informers, eavesdroppers, surveillance. After 10 minutes of this, he slowed his pace for me to catch up, and we walked while talking beneath his umbrella as the streets of the city bounced and sparkled with rushing water. "I found a soldier who'll take you to the Cronus Club," he whispered. "He says it must be only you."
"Do you believe him?"
"I checked him out. He's not with the PLA, even though he wears the uniform. He says to tell you that this is his 7th life. He said you would know what that means."
I nodded. "Where do I meet him?"
"Tonight. Beihei, 2 a.m.
"If I don't contact you in 12 hours, I replied, "you're to pull out of the city."
He nodded briskly. "Good luck," he hissed, and with a single shake of my hand, slipped back into the darkness. Beihei Park.
In spring, you can barely move for the throngs of people come to enjoy the fresh flowers and leaves on the trees. In summer, the surface of the lake thickens with water lilies, and in winter, the white stupa is disguised behind the frost in the trees. At 2 a.m. in 1958, it is a good place to get into trouble. I waited by the westernmost entrance to the park and monitored the progress of the rain as it seeped through my socks. I regretted that I had not seen Beihei in happier times and resolved that, should I live to the early 1990s, I would come back here as a tourist and do the things that tourists do, perhaps choosing an affably harmless passport to travel on, such as Norwegian or Danish. Surely even the most vehement of ideologues couldn't find anything wrong with Norway. A car came up the empty street towards me, and of course the car was for me. There were few enough cars on the streets of Beijing, and I felt no great surprise when it came to stop directly in front of me. The door was pushed open, and a voice called out in clear, crisp Russian,
"Please get in."
I got in. The interior of the car stank of cheap cigarettes. There was a driver in front and another man in the passenger seat, a military cap pulled down across his forehead. I turned to the third man who'd pushed open the rear door for me to get in. He was small, silver-haired, dressed in a neat grey tunic and trousers. He had a gun in one hand and a sack, also smelling of cigarette smoke, in the other.
"Please forgive this," he said, as he pulled the sack over my head.
An uncomfortable journey. The roads weren't much to speak of, and the car suspension had been welded in by a stonemason resentful of his change in career. Whenever we neared a crowded area, I was politely asked to put my head down beneath the front seats, an action which required considerable shuffling of knees, as the front seats were a bare breath away to begin with. I sensed the move into countryside by the swelling of the engine as we reached open roads, and was politely informed I could sit up and relax, but please not to remove the bag from my head. As we travelled, the radio played recordings of traditional music and selected highlights from Mao's greatest speeches. My companions, if I can call them that, were silent. I didn't know how long the drive took, but by the time we came to a stop, I could hear the first trillings of the dawn chorus. There were leaves rustling against each other in the damp morning breeze, and thick mud underfoot, as I was guided, still blindly, out of the car. A step up to a wooden porch, the swish of a door sliding sideways, and, just on the inside of the porch, the same polite voice of the man with the gun, asking if I minded them removing my shoes. I did not. I was patted down, briskly, professionally, and led through to another room by the arm. The room smelled ever so slightly of smoked fish, and as I was guided awkwardly into a low wooden chair, a source of warmth off to my right, another odour, green tea, was added to the medley. The bag was removed, at last, from my head, and, looking around, I found myself in a square, rush-floored room of eminently traditional design. There were no ornaments, save for a low wooden table and two chairs, one of which I sat in, but a great window looked out in front of me onto a small green pond, over whose surface the morning insects were beginning to flick with the approach of dawn. A woman came in, a pot of tea balanced expertly on a tray, and, carefully laying out two china cups, she poured me some of the brew. The other cup was filled and set opposite me, though there was as yet no one to drink it. I smiled, thanked her, and drank my cup down whole. Waiting. I waited, I estimate, 15 minutes alone with a pot of green tea and a cooling cup. Then the sliding door at my back moved again, and another woman entered. She was young, barely more than 15 years old, wearing flat sandals of woven reed, blue trousers, a quilted jacket, and a single lilac flower in her hair. She folded herself neatly into the chair opposite me with the merest smile of acknowledgement, took her cup of green tea, rolled it beneath her nose once to take in the by now cold odour, then sipped it carefully. She eyed me. I eyed her for a while. At last she said, "I am Yung, and I have been sent here to determine whether or not to kill you." I raised my eyebrows and waited for the rest. She laid her cup carefully back down on the tray, fingers straightening as she adjusted the little vessel to place it in perfect alignment with the pot and my own empty cup. Then, folding her hands in her lap, she went on. "The Cronus Club has been attacked. Members have been kidnapped, their memories erased. Two have been terminated before they are born, and we are still mourning their departing. We have always lived discreetly, but now we feel that we are under threat. How do we know that you are not a threat to us?"
"How do I know that you are not a threat to me?" I replied. "I, too, have been attacked. I, too, was nearly destroyed. Whoever is behind this must have had access to and knowledge of the club. This is an attack hundreds of years in the making, maybe thousands. My concerns are as valid as yours."
"Be that as it may, you sought us. We did not look for you."
"I came looking for the only Cronus Club which I know of as still being remotely intact. I came to pool resources, to determine if you had any information more than I currently possess, which could help me track down the one behind all this."
She was silent. Irritation flared up in some pit of my soul. I had been patient, 39 years of patience, no less, and was taking a considerable risk by even showing myself to these people. "I understand," I went on, trying to keep the rising frustration out of my voice, "that you are suspicious of me. But the simple truth is, if I were your enemy, I would not be placing myself so absolutely in your power. I have gone to great lengths to hide my identity, it is true, but this is only to hide my point of origin and physical location from whoever is attempting to destroy us. I can give you some intelligence as to who our mutual enemy might be. I hope you believe it is in your interests to share any information you may have as well." She was silent a good long while, but by now my irritation was nearly on par with my self-control, and I felt that to say anything more would probably be to lose any restraint I had left. Abruptly, she stood up, gave a little half-bow, and said,
"If you would wait here, I will consider this matter further."
"My cover is a Russian academic," I replied. "If I am to be detained indefinitely, I hope you will supply a means of extraction, should the need arise."
"Of course," she replied. "We would not wish to inconvenience you unnecessarily."
So saying, she left as abruptly as she had arrived. A few seconds later, the smiling man with the gun came back into the room.
"Did you enjoy the tea?"
he asked, pulling the sack back over my head and guiding me to my feet.
It's all in the simmering, you know.
They deposited me back where they'd found me, outside Behe Park. I had half an hour to get to a class and ran wildly through the streets, making it 2 minutes late to the classroom. My students, far from reproaching me for my tardiness, chuckled, and I gave a breathless lecture on agrarian collectivization and the benefits of chemical fertilizers, before dismissing them 3 minutes early and running even faster than I'd run from the park for the nearest toilet. No one ever considers the question of bladder when dealing with matters of subterfuge. For 4 days, I waited. They were 4 infuriating days, during which I knew perfectly well that my alibi was being checked and every aspect of my cover story examined by the Beijing Cronus Club. I was confident that they would find nothing. I had put enough safeguards between Professor Sing-Song and myself to necessitate a lifetime of investigation. On the 5th day, as I was walking out of the university and heading for my hall, a voice said from the shadow of a door, "Professor?" I turned. The teenage girl I had met in the house by the pond stood there, wearing khaki and carrying a satchel over one shoulder. She looked even more a child than before, dressed in her baggy panted uniform.
"May I speak with you, Professor?" she inquired.
I nodded, gesturing towards the street. "Let me get my bicycle," I said. We walked together sedately back through the city streets, my foreign skin and undeniably quirky nose attracting all the usual stares, only enhanced by the presence of the girl by my side.
"I have to congratulate you," she murmured as we walked, "on the thoroughness of your preparations. Every document and contact indicates that you are who you claim to be, a great achievement considering that you are not."
I shrugged, eyes scanning the street, looking for anyone who took too great an interest in our discussion. "I've had a while to get this sort of thing right."
"Perhaps it was your skill with subterfuge which saved you from being targeted," she mused. "Perhaps that was how you escaped the forgetting?"
"I was dead by Watergate," I replied. "I suspect that played a bigger part."
"Indeed. There was no indication of anything amiss until 1965. That was the year club members began to disappear. At first we thought they were simply being assassinated, their bodies buried in unmarked graves. Such things have occurred before, when linear authorities take too much interest in us, and will occur again, I think. But our own deaths and returns to life showed a far more sinister trend. Those who were kidnapped and killed had their memories destroyed first, which is a form of death that the club cannot tolerate or accept. Here in Beijing, we have lost 11 members to the forgetting, 2 to pre-birth death."
"From what I've gathered from the other clubs," I replied softly, "that seems a fairly average pattern."
"There are more patterns," she added with a stiff nod. "No one killed pre-birth was prior to 1896. This implies that the murderer is too young to act before that time, assuming consciousness and faculties are obtained between 4 and 5 years old.
"That puts our murderer's birth at approximately 1890, yes?" I murmured. Another strict nod of agreement as we rounded a corner. Students bustled against us, scurrying by to classes. Several groups marched together, carrying giant banners proclaiming, "Students unite for the great leap forward," and other such tokens of impending calamity.
"The pre-birth killings appear to be targeted against older members of the club," she went on. "It would appear the intention is to remove the most active members of our kind, who might be in a position to interfere at the start of the 20th century. Naturally, their removal has an impact on the future generations of the century, who are more grievously affected by their loss than if, for example, you or I were removed."
"Don't be so hard on yourself," I joked, and she did not even flicker a smile.
"In 1931, there is a brief acceleration in the pre-birth murder rate. Where before the worldwide average for club losses was 6 a year, concentrated mainly in Europe and America, in 1931 there is a spike to 10 losses a year, including 3 in Africa and 2 in Asia."
"The murderer reaching maturity," I suggested, "growing more active?" Yet, even as the words passed my lips, I discarded them for the more obvious, more simple possibility. "Another Kalachakra, one born later, is joining the killings." I sighed, and of course I knew who.
"This seems most likely," she confirmed. "The year in which the killings spike suggests a birthday around 1925.
Yes, I could well believe Vincent was born in that year.
"What about the forgettings?" I asked.
"Is there any pattern there?"
They began in 1953, starting with the Leningrad Kronos Club. At first we assumed the club had suffered some great political damage through the actions of the Liniers. But in 1966, both Moscow and Kiev were hit, with 80% of the members of those clubs kidnapped, their memories erased, and their bodies destroyed. 80%? I couldn't keep the astonishment out of my voice. That high? Clearly, the perpetrator has been monitoring the club's activities for a long time, taking note of its members. By 1967, most clubs in Europe had been hit, as well as 5 in America, 7 in Asia, and 3 in Africa. Those members who had evaded attack were sent underground, and all clubhouses ordered closed until 2070, by which date it was assumed our attacker would be deceased. Messages were left in stone for future generations, warning them of the danger. So far, we've received no whisper reply.
As the girl talked, my mind raced. I had known the situation was bad, known that Vincent had spread himself far and wide. But this was on a scale I hadn't even considered possible.
By 1973, the attacks on our kind were slowing, thanks to the methods employed for our own protection. But those survivors who were not exemplary in their security still risked exposure and the forgetting. In 1975, a final bulletin was issued from the Beijing Kronos Club, urging all surviving members to take their own lives at once, to evade any pursuers in this life. Regrettably, a twitch in the corner of her mouth that might have been sorrow, we did not predict that after the mass forgettings inflicted upon us, our enemy would then seek to destroy so many pre-birth. We believed our attacker to be a linear agency, perhaps a government apprised of our existence. We did not realize that the perpetrator could be one of our own. The loss has been extraordinary. We tried to find out who was attacking us, who was bringing us down, but this crime was planned, organized and executed with a stark brutality that left us reeling. We had grown complacent, I believe. We had grown lazy. We will not be caught so off guard again.
For a while, we walked in silence. I was still too stunned to speak. How much had I missed, courtesy of my early death? And to what extent, I wondered, had Vincent's all-out attack on the Kronos clubs been a consequence of my actions, of my refusing to cooperate and threatening to expose him once and for all? Clearly, the attack had been planned for a long while. But was I not partially responsible for bringing it to a head? The pre-birth murders, I said at last. If they've been going on since 1896 of this life, that gives you over 50 years to investigate them. Do you have any leads?
It's been difficult, she conceded. Our resources limited. Those who died. We did not know their points of origin, and can only conclude that they have been murdered by the simple fact that they have not been born. However, we have made some progress and narrowed our list of suspects down. In its way.
A wry smile now, as humorless as a tomb.
The loss of life among our people makes it easier to predict who might be our villain. By focusing on a specific time, a specific place, there are only so many candidates for this deed.
Do you have names? I asked.
We do. But before I tell you all, I must ask you, Professor, what is it you intend to offer me?
For a moment, I nearly told her all. Vincent Rankis, the quantum mirror, all our research together. But no, too much danger, for where could knowledge of this have come if not from me?
How about a vast organized criminal network that spans the globe, I said, capable of finding anyone, anywhere, and buying anything at any price.
Will that do?
She considered.
It would do.
She gave me a name.